From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. School is back in session at some systems around the area. CMS opens their doors next Tuesday. As the new school year begins, we examine some of the challenges and opportunities faced by area school districts and by teachers and students in the coming months. But we start with the impact on schools and on public health of a recent executive order issued by Donald Trump, reducing the number of childhood vaccinations recommended by the federal government from 17 to 11. Vaccine skepticism has been given a voice by this administration, and recommendations do not match the science. What you should know about that and more this hour on Charlotte Talks. First, the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. School is back in session in some communities surrounding Charlotte, and CMS starts next Tuesday. So this hour, we look at what you need to know as school gets underway. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, we want to examine some medical advice from the federal government that has recently changed when it comes to childhood vaccinations. Some of it runs counter to proven medical science, and it not only impacts public health, but also making sure kids headed off to school are healthy and safe to themselves and those around them. Dr. Elizabeth Portis is a pediatrician and program manager of the Prenatal Through 5 initiative at Mecklenburg County Public Health. She is also a pediatrician at Union County Public Health in their child health clinic. Welcome, doctor. Nice to have you with us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
So pediatricians are on the front line of medicine for children and their parents. For years, the CDC has published guidance on how and when children should be vaccinated for certain diseases. Following those recommendations has kept diseases at bay, diseases that used to cause severe illness and death in some cases. They've stopped these vaccinations have stopped the spread of polio and measles and whooping cough and mumps and other illnesses. But vaccine skepticism has been on the rise in recent years, and it's been given a voice in the Trump administration. So now they have suggested a different vaccine regimen for children, reducing the number of diseases on the schedule from, I think, 17 to 11. And changing the timing of vaccines, which we'll talk about. But what's your impression? What are your thoughts about decreasing the number of diseases?
Mike, first, thank you so much for having me on the air and bringing up this very important topic that is affecting parents and children, our public health systems, as well as physicians. So the first thing that we as physicians do when there is any new guidance or publications or suggestions about clinical changes, including what is in this executive order, is we go back to the evidence and the science. We pull the primary literature to reread the studies. And time again, the studies have shown that include millions of children that our current vaccine regimen, which was published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, works, helps keep kids safe, and helps provide prolonged immunity for children.
So how do you explain this policy shift?
Thank you, Mike. As we know, there have been no new scientific studies that led to this policy shift or the executive order, which I want to make clear for parents out there. There have been no changes to the vaccine schedule or the vaccine requirements for our public schools in North Carolina. What we know from the executive order is this was based on comparison with other countries. And as a physician and a scientist, comparison with other countries does not meet the rigor of clinical studies that we use to determine vaccine efficacy and safety.
Now, the North Carolina, this is where it gets confusing for parents, I think, who are genuinely concerned about wanting to do the right thing for their children. But the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has reaffirmed the importance of vaccines to protect children. And you have just said nothing has changed in terms of the protocols to get kids into school, at least not in Mecklenburg County. So is all of this in conflict with what the federal government is saying? And if so, what message does that send to parents?
I have two in CMS.
Hold on for just a second. We're losing your we're losing your feed. Try again.
Mike, can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mike, for that question. The other lens I wear besides my professional hat is I am a parent myself. I have two young children in CMS schools. I'm a neighbor, a friend, and an aunt. And so I get peppered with questions from people within my life around vaccines. And what I feel, and I know other parents feel, is that this executive order is adding a lot more confusion to an already very busy time of back to school. We know that emotions and tasks run high right now at this time, and that this executive order is not actually changing anything today for kids in our school systems. So for parents who want to follow the vaccine schedule, as this executive order suggests breaking out, for example, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, parents may be asking themselves, do I need to make additional appointments with my doctor just to finish this vaccine series? And the answer is no. At this time, we are unable to separate out MMR into individual vaccines. Not all those vaccines exist and would need further study to see if they work being given individually. For those parents who choose to opt out of vaccines, I also think that this executive order adds confusion because it's not actually changing any of the vaccine requirements for schools across the country right now. And it's adding more publicity to unscientific claims.
You are in charge, at least in Mecklenburg, of the prenatal through five initiative. So let's talk about the old, because we know that vaccinations begin almost at birth, and in some cases do begin at birth for children. But by the time they're ready to enter pre-K or kindergarten or first grade, what inoculations, what shots should these children have received? Which ones must they have received to get into school?
Mike, thank you for that. So the best source of information for parents is the North Carolina Vaccine Requirements website. And I'm happy to read some of the diseases that kids are required to be vaccinated against for school requirements to ensure that our kids are entering school healthy and ready to learn. So these include polio, measles, mumps, and rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, Haemophilus influenza, hepatitis B, chickenpox, pneumococcal disease, which can cause meningitis and pneumonia. Those are the required vaccines for our kindergartners. And in different age groups, there's additional vaccines.
And that's a lot of vaccinations going on there for people who are 5 years old and younger. Are most of those done? Well, most of them are done over a series of years, one would presume, but are most of them done at the same time? Like the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is a triple vaccine given in one shot. How many of these other vaccines are like that? We've lost you again.
Six of our disease. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
At least six of our diseases are given in combined vaccines. And based on the patient ages, there can be additional combined vaccines.
So South Carolina's vaccination rate is 92 to 93%, which is below the 95% that's required for herd immunity this year, or any year for that matter. South Carolina has added now this year a requirement of two doses of the chickenpox vaccine for children who have not yet had the disease. They also require vaccinations in South Carolina for hepatitis A and B, tetanus, whooping cough, polio, measles, mumps, and rubella at a minimum. How does that compare to what we require in North Carolina? I tell you what, doctor, you keep turning your mic off when I ask questions. Don't turn it off anymore, because when it comes back on, it doesn't come back on. So go ahead and answer the question. Try that now.
We are very much aligned with the South Carolina Vaccine Regiment and the American Academy of Pediatrics Regiment.
Nationally, the number of exemptions given to children entering kindergarten was at an all-time high I believe last year and the year before. How dangerous is that?
We know each vaccine preventable specific
All right, we're having significant problems with your microphone. I'm not sure where the microphone is, but try again.
Each vaccine preventable disease has a specific percentage of people that need to be covered to prevent widespread of that disease. We only have a very small margin where a vaccine preventable disease can go from impacting one or two people to impacting an entire community. So as more parents are exempting their children out of vaccines, the likelihood for a vaccine preventable disease to spread increases significantly.
Why do school systems, why does the state of North Carolina, or any state for that matter, allow these exemptions?
Mike, that is a very good question. I think within the medical community, there is a range of perspectives on that exact question. The American Academy of Pediatrics has some literature as well as some stances talking about that we should decrease the types of exemptions that families can get. Medical exemptions, we know, have to be there. There are kids for certain reasons due to their clinical conditions that cannot get vaccines, and including live virus vaccines. That would require talking to our state legislators as well as our public. I do want to emphasize here that a study out of Harvard in 2025 showed that 4 out of 5 Americans support vaccine requirements in schools.
Who's more at risk when a child is not properly vaccinated or doesn't have a sufficient vaccination to meet what we require in any of these states, including our own? Who's at risk? Is it the child who is unvaccinated, or is it the people around them?
Mike, thanks for the question. When a child is not vaccinated and there is a vaccine
All right,
preventable disease study,
once again, doctor, once again, we're having a problem. So try it again. Go.
I'll see. When a child is not vaccinated for a vaccine preventable disease, this doesn't impact only the child that is not vaccinated, but other children or community members that they may come across who themselves are unvaccinated, who may be too young to be vaccinated, or people who are not yet at the age where they are fully vaccinated.
There's a lot of fear-mongering and mis- and disinformation being disseminated that runs counter to the science. I've said that before, and some of it is coming from the people at the top of the federal government. Why a parent would choose to believe a bureaucrat or a politician with an axe to grind or an ideology to promote, rather than doctors and scientists who have spent their lives studying disease, it's a mystifying thing that they do this. But have you found that when a pediatrician sits down with a parent who may be very concerned about vaccines, who may be a vaccine skeptic themselves, that they respond more to talking one-on-one with their doctor, their child's doctor, than they might to these recommendations coming on from on high from any government at any level? Does it work better when they speak directly to the doctor?
Certainly, Mike. We recommend that families who have questions about vaccines speak directly to their pediatrician or their healthcare provider. We know from surveys that pediatricians are the number one trusted source of information for parents, and we really partner with parents on how to keep their child healthy, happy, safe, and thriving. In my own clinic, I have discussions with families about vaccine questions and hesitancy, and to really understand the direction or the questions a family has allows me to individualize my response and address that person's specific concerns.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about these new recommended protocols and specifically about the splitting up of the MMR vaccine into three different shots and the problems that presents, not just for the medical community, because there is no separate shot at the moment for these, as you mentioned, but for parents and for doctors and the burden that puts on parents to have to come back to the doctor more than once for these individual shots. We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment, we'll talk to two education reporters about things you need to know about what's going on in school districts around the Charlotte area. But we're talking right now to Dr. Elizabeth Portis, a pediatrician and program manager for the Prenatal Through 5 Initiative for Mecklenburg County Public Health. She is also at Union County Public Health as their child in their child health clinic as well. The new guidelines that just came down through executive order from Donald Trump were established by Trump. It reduces the number of childhood vaccines recommended by the government from 17 to 11. We've spoken about that. It's an attempt to accomplish goals similar to those enacted by the CDC in January, but which were later struck down by the court. So once again, another attempt at an end run around the courts. And it calls for the breaking up of this shot known as the MMR, which is a combination of vaccines for measles, mumps, and rubella, into separate shots. They still recommend inoculation against those diseases, but they want you to get the shots at a different time. And as you said a moment ago, those vaccines separately do not exist. Is that the only problem that you see with that recommendation?
Mike, yes. In addition to the feasibility of that, the other problem is this will put a lot of additional logistical concerns on parents. For parents who want to fully vaccinate their children, this would include separate visits to the doctor. That includes taking more time off of work, taking your child out of daycare, interrupting your daily life to go to the doctor. We know that if we put additional obstacles and challenges in front of very busy parents who are trying to do the best thing for their children, things will fall through the cracks. We do have examples from other countries where vaccine preventable diseases that were all part of the same inoculation were separated out. And the amount of children that were covered by those vaccines decreased and the disease increased within the country.
Now, there's nothing wrong with questioning science. Scientists question the science. That's how science is done. But is there anything to indicate that the feelings that this vaccine, the MMR vaccine, should be broken up into individual vaccines for the benefit of young children, it's better for their health? Is there anything at all to back that up? Or is it simply an opinion?
I have not seen any studies.
Start again, because once again, we're having a problem.
I have not read any studies that show that breaking up vaccines works better or is safer for children. The contrary, I have read studies that show that this can be more harmful to children and a community.
Donald Trump and RFK Jr. have repeatedly made the connection between some vaccines and the rise in autism cases. Science insists that connection does not exist. But if you keep talking about it, some are going to believe it. If you tell a lie often enough, it becomes the truth. So tell me once and for all why scientists are confident that these vaccines do not cause autism. I'm not sure what the problem is, because when you talk, it's fine, but when it sometimes it's not. So let's try it one more time. Tell me why vaccines don't cause autism. It's not working. Try again. I'm sorry. It's just not working. Go ahead.
We have seen that show that vaccines do not cause autism, including a Danish study recently of over 600,000 children that did not show a connection between autism and vaccines, including in children more susceptible to autism.
We had a major outbreak of measles this year around the country for the first time in decades, 2,566 cases nationwide. It was the highest number in 35 years. This is a disease that we had virtually eradicated from the United States, but several children actually died for lack of inoculation, from this disease in the last year. In South Carolina, nearly 1,000 cases of measles broke out in a cluster mostly in upstate South Carolina around Spartanburg. I think we had three cases in Mecklenburg County, one in Cabarrus, I think, if my memory is serving properly. Why the difference? Why so many in South Carolina? And given the proximity and the travel back and forth from this area to Spartanburg by many people, why didn't it spread more quickly?
Mike, that's a great question, and there's one answer, is vaccines. We know that in pockets and communities where there is significantly reduced vaccine uptake, diseases such as measles can spread very quickly and very widely. Vaccines are the number one way to stop the spread of disease quickly and to protect individuals from getting the disease.
So, any final words of wisdom, any recommendations, any assurances, any advice you'd like to give to parents who are really confused about what's going on in the world of vaccines, particularly with politicians interfering with the science?
Right. Talking to parents, parent to parent, I understand a lot of the confusion and the questions that you have. As someone who truly trusts in vaccines and vaccinate my children, I encourage you to bring up your questions to your pediatricians, to look at the American Academy of Pediatrics website. They have some videos on myths and facts and how misinformation gets spread very, very quickly on social media around vaccines.
Dr. Liz Portis is a pediatrician, program manager of the Prenatal Through Five Initiative with Mecklenburg County Public Health and also at Union County Public Health and their Child Health Clinic. Thank you so much for your time this morning. I appreciate it. Now, on to other aspects of back to school, as seen through the eyes of two reporters who cover the story every day. James Farrell is WFAE's education reporter, and Rebecca Noel is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. They both join us now. Good morning to you both. James, you attended, actually, both of you and Rebecca attended a CMS press conference yesterday. It was the first public appearance by Superintendent Crystal Hill since she was suspended for the course of an investigation about which we still know very little. What did she have to say, if anything, James, about that investigation?
Yeah, so she kind of started off the press conference, and CMS staff kind of instructed that they would not be answering questions that weren't related to back-to-school operations. Hill kind of started the press conference saying that she wanted to acknowledge the events of the last few weeks, but that this was not the time or place to talk about that. The focus was on back-to-school. After some reporters kind of continued to press the issue and asked questions, she did say that there would be a time for more information a little later on. She didn't specify when that would be or what kind of information she would be willing to share at that time. So kind of there was this promise of more information about this thing, which again is kind of has been a mystery, but we still don't know the specifics of when that might happen or what that might look like.
So I've seen some news reports on television about this press conference yesterday, Rebecca, and she's smiling broadly in most of the shots that I'm seeing on TV and in the Observer this morning. There's a smiling photograph of Crystal Hill. I don't think it was taken at that meeting, but she's nonetheless smiling very broadly. And there has been some concern as a result of this investigation about her relationship going forward with the board. Stephanie Sneed, who is the school board chair, seems to think that they can have a good working relationship. Did Dr. Hill say anything yesterday that might indicate otherwise?
Not that I saw. I didn't see her say anything in particular about her working relationship with the board. She was asked, since yesterday, they said specifically they only want this to pertain to back to school operations. A reporter did ask, well, how did being suspended for 2 months, how is that going to impact back to school operations? And she said that she is, quote, 100% confident that schools will function as normal on the first day. So she didn't give any kind of indication that she believes that the suspension will have lingering effects, or at least she's not telling us that she believes that if she does.
And Mary Ramsey, go ahead, James, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add as a brief little thing, just to note that some of the board members were at the press conference yesterday. Four of them, I think, including Stephanie Sneed. We didn't see any interaction between them and Dr. Hill, but they were there, and I think that was noteworthy.
Mary Ramsey, another reporter of The Observer, wrote an article this morning that talked about during the question and answer portion of the event, an attendee asked whether the investigation into Hill will affect county funding for CMS because they get $730 million from the budget, from the county budget. What was that even brought up? I mean, was a meeting with Mike Bryant, the county manager. Was that brought up at all as a concern at this meeting yesterday at the school board?
No. Funding was not something that was addressed at all. It was mostly some sort of logistical things about returning to school, some changes in terms of what the district will be doing with technology. They're going to be implementing some changes with not allowing students in kindergarten through second grade to access YouTube independently, putting some restrictions on when students can use devices, which echoes some things that parents have brought up as concerns in the last few weeks. And then they spoke a little bit about just some updates on teacher shortages. I believe they said I have some notes in front of me. They said there were 161 teacher vacancies in CMS right now, 98 bus driver vacancies. But yeah, that's about all they talked about. They didn't talk about funding at all.
And although that sounds alarming, 161 teacher vacancies and 98 bus driver vacancies, that's not unusual as we approach the start of the school year. I'm wondering why that is, particularly now that starting teacher salaries are at the top of the heap in the country, I think, or at least in the Southeast with these recent raises. Why is it so hard?
Right, in the Southeast for sure. And they said that there's 161 teacher vacancies. That is about 50 lower than they had this time last year. So it's been a substantial decrease. We can't say definitively that that's because of the salary increases for beginning teachers, but I would think that may have had some effect if it's more affordable to live in Mecklenburg County, especially. Bus driver vacancies, it's around the same number that we had last year as well. So there has been a decrease in teacher vacancies this year when compared to last year. But of course, yeah, not all of those roles are filled. CMS has about 9,000 teachers, just to give context. So it's 161 out of about 9,000, just to give context for what that looks like.
It's not a lot. James.
Yeah, and to kind of add to that, they said it was about a 98% fill rate. I did try to ask if they had a breakdown of like new teachers versus experienced teachers. They didn't have that information handy. I was told they might be able to get that to me later, but that would kind of help maybe shed some light too in terms of maybe the impact of starting pay or the difference between the experience levels of who's in the classrooms right now too.
So school starts Tuesday in Mecklenburg County, and that's because the law says that schools are required to start no earlier than the Monday closest to August 26th. That would make it August 24th this year. I don't know what that means, or why that is that way, but that's the way it is. And yet, there are several schools around the area that have already been in session for a while. Cabarrus, Gaston, Cleveland, Stanley all started on August the 12th. Iredell Statesville Schools and Kannapolis City Schools did as well. Mooresville opened their schools on August the 5th. Rebecca, why these scofflaws?
Yeah, it has to do with testing. So CMS board members for the last few years have actually been pushing for the state to change the law because the way that the calendar is set up right now with how rigid it is, what happens is they finish the first semester, they go on a two-week winter break, and then students are tested by the state on the content from that first semester. Whereas if you begin earlier, you can do that testing before winter break. And so they're concerned with how their scores are going to look compared to districts where students are tested before they have a 2-week break period. And right now, charter schools are not held to the same calendar laws that traditional public schools are. So a lot of charter schools start earlier as well, and are not beholden to that law. But also, for the schools, I think it's about 25% of school districts in the state are starting earlier than the law says they can at this point. And it's because it's a bit of a toothless law. They're not enforcing it really. There's not really a lot of penalties, if any, for districts that are starting earlier than they're supposed to. But historically, CMS has said that they won't do that, even if, other districts haven't seen penalties. CMS tends to be very, very cautious and not want to flout state law.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I don't know whether the two of you have been around long enough to know the answer to this question. But at one point, a previous school board, not the one we currently have, toyed with the idea of just starting when they want to, like these other school districts, and then decided not to. I'm wondering if there's no enforcement, why? If they want to do it, just do it. James?
Well, so there's been, no official enforcement. In the past, some school districts have faced lawsuits from businesses who want the school districts to have longer summer periods for, tourism and things like that. So while there's no like state level enforcement, there is kind of this this other kind of enforcement that can come from the private sector. And obviously, this law in and of itself was kind of born out of lobbying from the tourism industry that wanted to see a longer summer period for more vacation, more spending, and things like that. So I think it really just depends on school boards' kind of willingness to take a chance and take a risk there. And like Rebecca said, CMS has historically been cautious around this issue, even as they've been lobbying for these earlier start dates as well.
And since charter schools are technically public schools and they get their funding from tax dollars that come out of the CMS budget in our situation here in Mecklenburg County, why are they not held to the same standards? Why do they get to play by a different set of rules, not just on this, but in so many other areas?
Yeah, well, I think that has to do with what charter schools as a concept were sort of started to do, which is the idea behind a charter school is that they can be more innovative in their education practices. It's sort of seen as a laboratory or a place where you can test out some different practices that maybe then you can implement in public. Traditional public schools. That's sort of what charter schools as a concept were created to do. So, because of that, they do have some exemptions from rules that traditional public schools have to follow.
Teacher pay was increased this year thanks to the long-awaited budget that finally passed and was signed into law not too long ago by Governor Josh Stein. We're going to talk about the impact of that and when it kicks in for all these teachers and the fate of bonuses that were promised as well to these teachers. We'll talk about some CMS changes on in the offing, and then we'll do a little hopscotch around the area into Cabarrus, Gaston, and Union County schools as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with two education reporters. James Farrell covers education for WFAE News, and Rebecca Noel is the education reporter at the Charlotte Observer. The state budget finally passed, and in that budget were teacher pay raises. James, have all those raises gone into effect?
I believe that they have. I think the bonuses we might still be waiting on, I think those are expected to come in the fall, if I'm correct about that. But yes, I believe otherwise they have taken effect.
And where does this place CMS and other Charlotte area schools in terms of teacher pay as compared to nearby states?
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact ranking now, and we obviously have to see what other states have done with their teacher pay as well. I do know, I mean, this is definitely an improvement, particularly for starting teacher pay. That's where we see the biggest difference here. The overall package had an average 8% increase for teachers, but that was much larger for starting teachers. It was about 17%. It increased the base state paid salary from $41,000 to $48,000, which should make it more competitive with what North Carolina has historically been in the past. When you factor in county supplements, that should get most teachers above the $50,000 mark. But veteran teachers saw more modest pay raise of about 5%. And more noteworthy, we also saw that the pay scale still remains frozen from years 15 to 25, which has been a longstanding complaint from veteran educators. That was not addressed in this raise.
And Rebecca, this is kind of a pattern where we give a bigger bump to starting teachers, I guess, to attract them into the profession, but we don't give a nice bump to the people who have experience and higher degrees. And that has rubbed some people the wrong way. If you've talked to teachers about these raises that are now kicking in and the bonuses that are coming their way a little bit later on, how have they reacted to this? Are they happy? Are they unhappy? How would you describe them?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the veteran educators that I've spoken to are, I guess, sort of disappointed but not surprised, is sort of how they've described it to me, is that particularly when you factor in inflation, when you factor in, this is a 5% raise, but that's also a 5% raise after a year of not having a raise at all. A lot of these folks feel unappreciated, I guess, is a way that a lot of particularly veteran educators feel, because they feel there's been more and more added to their plate, but that they're not necessarily seeing pay increases that reflect the work that they do and the importance of that work. I don't think they want it to come across, though, like they begrudge higher raises for beginning teachers, because the issue really was that beginning teachers were not really at a living wage. And if you look at just the data of when teachers leave the profession the most, there's a huge spike within the first 5 years, and there's a huge spike after 25 years. And in the middle, there's not people, they say they'll leave, people don't leave at the rates that they probably think they will later. So I think it was a strategy to try to keep beginning teachers where they are.
You may have answered my next question already, but I'll ask it anyway, and you can add or subtract from it. If we continue to raise starting teacher salaries more frequently and to a greater degree than we do for experienced teachers, do we run the risk of becoming a training ground for beginning teachers who then leave the system to get a better salary after they have some time under their belts?
I mean, I think you could run that risk for sure. I think right now they're basing it on what they've seen the pattern be. But from what I've heard from veteran teachers, I think a lot of them are very tired of not really seeing substantial pay increases as the cost of living has continued to go up.
James.
Yeah, I think I've heard a lot of the same things from veteran teachers. I think younger teachers, too, when they're thinking about staying here in Charlotte, this is part of the things that they're considering as well, because it raises questions about, yes, this might be a good starting salary for me now. It might help me, have a living wage here in Mecklenburg County. But in the long run, when I'm thinking about wanting to have a career here or starting a family, and I have that long period of stagnation where I'm not getting a raise, is this going to be able to support that? And that's something that I've heard from teachers as well, just kind of the concern about what this does for teachers who are trying to plan out their careers and see themselves here long term, either in CMS or other districts in the state, or whether they look towards South Carolina or some of the other other regions around us too.
So as we head toward the first day of school, which is next Tuesday at CMS, let's go through some changes that CMS has announced as they prepare to open their doors. The school board just approved a series of changes to overhaul the system's magnet programs. These will take effect in the next school year. James, what should folks expect?
Yeah, so this has been in the works for a few months now. First came up at the board retreat in January, and they've been working through it ever since. In a nutshell, they want to take the district's 16 magnet themes. So magnets are schools that you apply to that anyone from the county can apply to go to these. And they usually have some kind of educational theme like Montessori or arts or something like that. Right now, there's 16 themes that you can pick from. They want to streamline that down into 6. They're reducing some of the offerings around the county that maybe are duplicative or under-enrolled, or that they feel like the magnet theme is not really being utilized well. And they're trying to streamline their resources around kind of quality over quantity is kind of what we've heard on this. So the 6 themes that we have to pick from are, or that will be taking effect in 27-28, are arts, Montessori, early colleges. I'm trying to remember them all here. There is arts, Montessori, early college. They want to combine an international baccalaureate program with the LITD program, but that's a change that they're going to hold off on until December. So there's kind of this streamlining of these magnet themes down to six.
So, change is always disruptive, Rebecca. How disruptive are parents and students likely to find these magnet school changes in the next school year?
Well, I think it depends. If you're currently in one of the programs that's being sunsetted, obviously that could be pretty disruptive. They're trying to put within each of these six themes options within each sort of part of the city. They're splitting the city into three sort of transportation zones. So the idea is that people can get transportation more easily to a place close enough to their home where they can have these options and also can follow that track K through 12 if they decide to do so. So I think it depends on what families are looking for. It depends on where they want their kids to go. The only difference within that is one caveat is with the performing and visual arts, there's only going to be three, like an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school district wide. So that's a district wide program. They're not going to have different programs in each of those transportation zones.
So let's hopscotch around the area a bit here. Last year, Rebecca, Gaston County Schools faced several financial crises or woes. The superintendent had to go to the county for more money mid-year because financial projections didn't turn out to be accurate. And then in July, the Gaston County Commission voted to increase their investment in schools by $5 million, reversing a previous decision to keep funding flat. Some parents have long complained in Gaston County that the Commission does not sufficiently fund their schools. From what you can tell, how healthy financially are they now?
I would think it's still pretty tenuous. Basically, they got $54 million originally from the county for this year, which would keep it at a flat budget. They weren't going to increase it at all. And like you said, the county ultimately went back after a series of closed door meetings with school board members and county commissioners. They decided to go back and add an additional $5 million onto that. That still doesn't meet the original around $60 million ask that the district had presented to the county. It gets it much closer, but it doesn't quite meet that ask. Last year, when they had to come sort of hat in hand the district to the county and ask for about $10 million back in the spring, it was because they said that a former employee of the district had basically, when creating the budget for this year, they hadn't factored in several funding streams that are no longer there. So there's COVID relief funding, which has which in effect for a few years from the federal government, but has now expired. There was also low wealth funding, which comes from the state for certain districts based on property values, and they've had skyrocketing property values in the last year or two, and so they've gotten much less of that money from the state than they had previously gotten. So I think they're still figuring a lot of those things out.
At one point, James, last year, Gaston County said the superintendent said they faced the possibility of cutting staff, and that might have, I don't know whether it included teachers or not, but cutting staff by somewhere around 500 people. And in this latest situation where they gave them $5 million, that averted a loss of 75 people. How tenuous is it at the moment in terms of being able to staff the schools there?
Yeah, I think it's pretty tight. And Rebecca, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure they did still cut. There were some positions that were cut. I just don't remember the exact number off the top of my head. But I also know, I mean, the district had asked in these closed door sessions for $11.3 million and they got $5 million. So certainly that shortfall is going to make it hard to continue the operations that the district was hoping to do. And I'm sure this is going to be a continued point of discussion. Residents have really been speaking out about this at meetings. It's been a really a hot topic and a big concern for people who want to see more funding go to schools. So we're going to see that continue to happen.
Rebecca.
Yeah, just in terms of those numbers for the layoffs, they did lay off. There was a threat of laying off about 400 people last spring, which the district in total has less than 4,000 employees, so that would be a big chunk of the district. They ended up laying off about 175 employees at the end of the year.
So Cabarrus County schools may also face a money crunch, and not unlike what we've been talking about in Gaston County. Commissioners in Cabarrus approved a 4.5% increase for schools, but that is not even close to what they were hoping for at the district. Talk about that, Rebecca.
Yeah, the district was hoping for an 8.3% increase, and they got 4.5%. So it certainly is nowhere near where they wanted it to be. Sort of similarly with Gaston County, there's this tension between the county commission and the school board about money and about how much funding the district says they need. So the county commission actually voted previously in April to block the school board from being able to present their budget proposal presentation at a meeting. And so the district was upset because they said, well, we didn't really get a chance to plead our case because you didn't let us give our presentation about why we want that 8.3% increase.
James, is this really growing pains? We have these districts surrounding Charlotte who are, just like Charlotte, growing by leaps and bounds because people are moving into the area. And suddenly, they have to provide education for a whole lot more people, and that explodes their budget to proportions that they've never had to consider before. Is that part of what's going on here?
Yeah, that's a big part. The growth is definitely a big part of what districts are trying to grapple with and trying to figure that out. But I think another really big part of this, especially this past budget cycle, was that we still had so much uncertainty about the state budget. That made it so hard to plan for administrators to figure out how they were going to spend their money. They were waiting for decisions from the state. I also just think there's this greater question of, because as school excuse me, as school advocates will tell you, they feel the state is not funding schools enough. That puts more pressure on counties to try to pick up that tab. And I think that leads to some of these tensions that we're seeing between local school boards and their counties. In Gaston County, as we're going to talk about Union County as well, that all plays into this as well.
Meanwhile, Cabarrus County will have $400 million in education bonds on their November ballot. One would bring $340 million to Cabarrus County and Kannapolis City Schools. The other would funnel $60 million into Rowan Cabarrus Community College. Rebecca, how are they proposing to use that money, and how might it affect taxes? We keep being told in Mecklenburg when they run these bonds, it doesn't affect taxes. Does it there?
Yes, it will affect taxes. That is where the money is coming from, is an increase in property taxes. The money is for capital projects and improvements to facilities. Basically, they've said that it's not for anything other than that. It's not for teacher pay. It's basically, they've said they have aging facilities that they have to do upkeep on, and they also want to open a couple of new schools, I believe an elementary school and a high school. So a lot of it is for that. And then in terms of the actual tax impact, they've said they're going to phase it in. But I think ultimately it'll be an increase sort of to the tune of, if you have a home valued at $400,000, it'll look like an increase of about $200 on your annual tax bill.
So I have just a couple of minutes left, James. Union County schools are also dealing with funding issues. Members of the Union County Board of Education could not accept an agreement with the county that would have freed up $3.8 million in funding for teacher and teacher assistant supplements. There were strings attached that the chair of the school board says created a, quote, agreement of manufactured mistrust. Explain that to me. What are they talking about?
Yeah, Mike. So this is actually a situation that's been going on for about a year, going back to the last budget cycle. There were supplements that got passed that were less than what teachers were expecting. It prompted some backlash. There was some finger pointing between the two boards about why this was the case. There was actually a minute where they weren't even sure if the supplements were coming. So that created a lot of tension and mistrust between these two boards at the time. They wrote these kind of scathing open letters toward each other. And that has kind of continued on. They had a joint meeting earlier this year where they talked about trying to put these differences aside, where the county proposed this idea of an interlocal agreement to do a $1,000 increase to teacher supplements, with kind of the stipulation that it only go to classroom teachers, not other certified staff like nurses or counselors. They said they felt like that's what they had agreed to last year, and that was not ultimately what ended up happening. The county has also been pushing for sort of like more transparency in the school budget. And school board members have really bristled at a lot of this, like you mentioned, kind of citing this feeling that there's this mistrust and that it's not coming from a good faith place.
Taking it back home to CMS for just a moment, there's a push by parents to reduce screens in the classroom nationwide. This is happening, and here a group of CMS parents is doing exactly that. They're advocating for specific policies. I have about 30 seconds. What are they asking for, and what, James, has been the response by CMS?
Sure. So they want to do things like getting rid of screens and devices for kids in grades K through 2, getting rid of tech during indoor recess, a bell-to-bell phone ban, and they want CMS to review its policies, its tech policies in general, to see where it can make improvements. CMS has said that they would start exploring some of this. They want to start limiting technology for kids in grades K through 2, and have said they will review their tech policies this year.
James Farrell is WFAE's education reporter. Rebecca Noel reports on education for the Charlotte Observer. I feel like we're in good hands when it comes to education reporting in Charlotte. You guys are great. Thank you for your time this hour. I appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah Dalia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Additional production assistance by Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.